I know you guys are like me. You've been waiting for this since January 6th. Football season is just about finally here. At least we have week three of the preseason, which is the closest dress rehearsal to the real deal. And you have DraftKings 1 week fantasy football. To celebrate, DraftKings is hosting a $100,000 contest that is totally free to enter. And if you draft the perfect lineup, you can win $1 billion. Here's the key. Get to DraftKings.com now. Use the promo code Ross Tucker to play in DraftKings' free week one contest with $100,000 in total prizes. And how could I forget? If you draft the perfect lineup, you can win $1 billion. That's promo code Ross Tucker to play for your shot to win $1 billion. $1 billion. Week one. The contest is totally free to enter. Why wouldn't you try? DraftKings, the game inside the game. Eligibility restrictions apply. See DraftKings.com for details.
It's the Ross Tucker Football Podcast.
Oh, yeah, it is. But it's not just any Ross Tucker football podcast. It is a Monster Monday, and it's presented by SeatGeek. By far the best way to get tickets for anything. There's some concerts coming up. I'm going to one on Saturday, thanks to the SeatGeek app, which you have to have on your phone. And if you even consider going to a preseason game, SeatGeek app. Enter promo code Ross to get $20 off. A lot to discuss today. Much to get into. I can't believe this is only the second to last week before we go daily. Monday through Friday. And you will all know that you only have to go one place to get your fill of NFL talk, NFL conversation, especially from a former player's perspective, an Ivy League meathead's perspective, with trying to provide some entertainment value as we roll along. A lot of news to get to, but I spoke with Chris Nowinski of the Concussion Legacy Foundation probably a couple weeks ago now at this point, shortly after the CTE study came out. But I didn't get a chance to play it yet because there had been so much other stuff going on. And we have Andrew and Greg. Hadn't had a chance to air it. I think it's really important as we head into another football season across America, and frankly important for me and my family, that we get to the bottom of the latest CTE study. And I asked Chris about some of the critiques that people have had about the study and some of the concerns that other people in the neuroscience field have had about it. He is today's big show.
The big show.
Well, it seems like I chat with him at least once a year, probably at least twice a year here on the Ross Tucker Football Podcast. And for good reason, he is Chris Nowinski, Dr. Chris Nowinski, I might add, co-founder and CEO of the Concussion Legacy Institute, or Concussion Legacy Foundation, up there with the Boston University CTE Center. Chris, always good to talk with you. Obviously, you guys were in the news fairly recently in a major, major way with the latest study that 110 out of 111 brains that Dr. McKee has examined have been found to have CTE. I guess the first question is the significance of this study or the new information as opposed to what we already knew or you and I have talked about, over the last couple of years.
Sure. This is the largest case series ever of football players. And essentially, it updates the numbers, but the numbers you'd been hearing the last few years weren't published. So this is the first published in a major medical journal case series, so you can see all the science behind the diagnostics, the how severe they were, all the symptoms they had. So it's a major advancements for CT science. But in the big picture, it doesn't answer the questions, the big questions we want about how do you diagnose this, how do you treat this. But it shows that we're actually now really, really well set up to answer those questions. We have enough cases to really start doing the serious science that needs to be done.
So obviously, you guys admit in the study that it's, I don't know what the terminology is, whether you call it a biased sample or at least not a random sample, because right now, Chris, all 111 brains, those are people who either they signed up to donate their brains or their families donated brains because they had some symptoms that were concerning. Is that correct?
It's not correct. It's a talking point that somehow evolved, come out. Not everybody thought they had symptoms. So a lot of these cases were outreach by me, in which the conversation I would have with them, Lisa McHale being one of the first, was, well, he'll be your control because he never had any symptoms during life. So it's probably a minority of the cases, but it's certainly not every case was symptomatic. Not every case the family thought they had it. So there's something to that. But it's also important to appreciate, people like to say we admit it's a biased sample. We recognize it, we acknowledge it, we write it, because most people aren't familiar with brain bank studies. Every brain bank in the world has a recruitment bias because people give those brains when they have the disease or symptoms of the disease in general. And so brain bank is not how you get to what's the prevalence of this disease, which is what everyone's concerned about and focused on. It was not meant to do that. But when we say 110 out of 111, we're making the point that it's really hard to find healthy cases. And the disease shouldn't, a disease that we used to say was a 1 in a million shot and never been seen in this population has now been seen almost every time in this population. And that we need to do some more work to figure out why.
So, okay, so a couple questions. What is the prevalence of CTE in totally normal people that have never played football at any level? Do we know that? Do we know what the percentage is for people that have never done any, played any football?
No one's, so there haven't been, there's never been like a regular population that's been sampled. The experts, believe in their experience, it's near 0%. It's a really small, if you actually look at the big U.S. picture of how many people have actually exposed themselves to repetitive brain trauma, it's a relatively small number that have for a very long time or for enough to be exposed to this. I think one of the best examples of that was the Mayo Clinic went through and reexamined, somewhere between 100 and 200 single TBI cases, so cases that show up in the brain bank had a record of one brain injury, but otherwise, normal. And zero of those cases had the disease. So that, I think, fits with the people we speak with their experience, that when they go back through the brain bank, they just don't see much of this disease. And if they do go back and find it, they usually can find a record of repetitive brain trauma.
Okay, so then that kind of answers my next question, I guess, which was if Dr. McKee and yourself, if you guys will be able to get, I don't know how you describe it scientifically, but more of a random sample that no one can say, well, this is a bias. Is there any way to get a quote unquote random sample so that it passes whatever
you wouldn't do that with a brain bank study. And it's really hard to do that, frankly, with a clinical study. So it's far too expensive to just take every Joe off the street and study their brain. So usually when you're trying to sample a population, you're going to recruit, like, say, I'm going to recruit all the surviving members of a football team who played 30 years ago. You already have biases because some have died and you don't know why. And then the people who are willing to show up, because all research is voluntary, are going to bias your sample. They're usually willing to show up because something's wrong or they're trying to prove that they're fine. So it's really hard to get that number without a simple way to diagnose this disease. Getting a random number is going to be hard.
I read an article in the Toronto Sun that was somewhat critical of some of Dr. McKee's conclusions. And I just wanted to get your reaction to the story. And I guess the one that stood out to me the most was that there are actually four different stages of CTE. and that I don't want to say that Dr. McKee lumped them all together, but she had them all in the same category, even though they could be very, very different. Coach me up, educate me on that part of it.
Sure. So basically, there's a small debate in the neuropathologist community about when do you start calling CTE CTE? What's the minimum lesion? And so, Dr. McKee is leading. You know, the federal government provided a grant for her to recruit, pull together the top neuropathologists to actually define that criteria, and that's actually something they're working on. The operational definition right now is that you have a certain type of lesion in a certain part of the brain. And that's led to some people who haven't actually reviewed the tissue or reviewed that to say, well, they're just, if you have one lesion, it's CTE. And the reality is there's no one with just one lesion. It's usually found in multiple places of the brain, the signature type of brain damage. So I would say that it's a healthy debate about what the minimum lesion is, but it's not a criticism of this study. Only 11 of the 177 cases met the lowest end of the criteria. So she's sort of focused on a couple of cases when the reality is almost all the cases had severe disease.
I also read a study at some point, Chris, and I'm sure you've seen it. I don't remember if it was like Minnesota or Wisconsin, but they went back and tracked like all these guys, all the men that played high school football versus the guys that didn't, to see who had dementia and who didn't. And they found that the guys that played high school football, that there was no greater incidence of dementia among them. Are you familiar with the study that I vaguely remember?
Yes, yes, yes. Very familiar.
Tell me about it.
So it's an interesting study. So they went back and they looked through, essentially they had medical records of this population and they had sort of access to yearbooks to see who was playing football. Yeah, I believe is how they sourced it. And they basically found that the ones who played weren't worse off cognitively than the ones who didn't. And there's a few ways to interpret that study. The way I like to interpret that is we have to remember this was an era in the 50s before the kind of helmets we had today with much, much smaller people. And especially in an era before youth football was a normal thing. You know, Pop Warner didn't start becoming a national organization until the 60s, and they were the first to really promote youth football. So you're dealing with a different population, one that didn't necessarily play the same game, didn't have the same helmets, and didn't have the same number of years played on the field. And so this supports sort of, I think, our general feeling that CTE is a dose-response relationship. The idea that the more years you play or the more hits you take, the greater risk of your disease. So in a time when there was no youth football, you're looking at a population of people who played between 1 and 4 seasons. And if that's your population, we know there's attrition in football, and everybody starts as a freshman and finishes as a senior. If you're looking at a low exposure population with those types of numbers, I'm not surprised that no effect was found. It points to, I think, our recommendation that, we might be okay. Football will not be as dangerous if we didn't tackle from ages 5 to 13 and we took out those years. We might end up like this study where the high school football players are fine. The other point I wanted to add was, although in that study, the part that's not admitted is that it was a very small sample relative to the effect they were looking for. And so it's not exactly a robust study. It was a relatively small population, depending on what they'd expect to see. And also the population was still relatively young. It wasn't like they were 80 and they could see different rates of dementia. That was mostly a pre-dementia population.
Got it. Okay. I also wanted to ask you, before I get specifically into next steps for you and for the Concussion Legacy Foundation, I also read in that same Toronto Sun story, I believe it was a Dr. Hazrati, maybe, that in the brains that she had examined, I don't know if it was, I can't remember, Dr. Hazrati, but in the brains that Dr. Hazrati examined, there was a 30% incidence of CTE. What are your thoughts on that part of it?
So it's it's interesting. It's, I mean, it's not what other people who are looking at American football are finding. But she's not looking at American football. She's looking at Canadian football. So there may be reasons for that. Canadian football may be a less dangerous game. We know it's different rules, although it's hard to exactly for you and I to remember which ones they are. But it's different rules. And again, it may, they may not have the same youth football exposure that the other ones have. So it's a surprising analysis because, you know, I sit there and watch each case get reviewed by the neuropathological team. And there's no question it's there when it's said to be there. And so we found it in about 2/3 of our cases. So it's not like the difference between 99% and 30%. But we also, you know, may be better recruiters, you know, in terms of identifying the right criteria to invite cases in.
So, Chris, ideally, what give me the steps that have to happen here for the advancement of CTE in terms of being able to help people? Is it first being able to diagnose it in living human beings? Is it trying to find ways to slow down the effects of it? Are these all things that you guys are working on at the same time? I mean, I'm guessing in medicine that there's a natural sort of methodology to what has to be accomplished first, you know, A, before you can get to B, before we can get to C.
So it's a good question, and there's sort of different arms of the research. So there's a lot of basic science that needs to happen to really identify targets for treatment. And so that's what's great about having a brain bank, is that the brain donations get shipped all over the world to scientists trying to understand different mechanisms of, you know, what's defining the disease, why is this breakdown happening, how does it progress, you know, how does it travel cell to cell. And so that's all happening as we speak. There's also clinical studies going on. So Dr. Stern is leading a big NIH-funded study to learn how to diagnose it in living people. What's special about diagnosing it in living people is that's what really gets clinical trials going. So there's a reason why nobody is studying CT in big pharma, and that's because there's no way to define it in a living population. They're not sure they're going to be treating the right people, so they'll never be sure if the drug actually works, and there's nothing to measure in terms of stopping the progression that they feel confident in. So that's a big key, so that there's treatments for you and me down the road if we need them. And then there's what's also special about the brain bank work, though, is it's going to help us figure out risk factors, which will help us understand prevention. So when you have a population this large of CT cases, you can look at things like exposure data to say, okay, you know, why is this person getting it and why is this person not? And one data point you look at is sports they played, positions they played, number of hits to the heads you think they took, number of years they played, when at age they were when they started, what sort of medications were they on during their life, what sort of genetics profile do they have, which is a whole big area of research we're just barely even talking about at this point. So there's a lot. I mean, we're you know, it's a shame that we didn't really start digging into CT until 10 years ago, while other diseases had decades more head start. But we're, you know, part of my job is to continue to try to recruit smart people into this field so that they will help develop treatments and help us really get our arms around this.
So I know I've asked you this one before, and I think that you equated it to smoking. But my question is, the prevalence of CTE, you know, it seems like there are certain guys that played 12 years in the NFL and they're totally fine, and other guys that played 12 years that aren't. Is, you know, how much of a genetic component is there to the spreading of the disease? And then how much of an impact, I guess, genetic component is there to the symptoms that people show when they have CTE? In other words, do you have two people, Chris, that both have stage 4 CTE and one had a lot of symptoms and the other had none? Does it work that way sometimes too?
So the answer to your question is sort of, you know, you're completely on the right track. And certainly would not with stage 4. Everyone with stage 4 has disease. But you're right that some people with stage 2 seem to be doing fine when they pass away from an unrelated cause. And some people with stage 2 are really struggling to maintain day to day. And there's a lot of factors to that, but we're only beginning to study them. One of them is certainly genetics, but we don't know which genes are responsible or how they're working because the work hasn't been done yet. But I can promise you there'll be things, future publications on genetics as to why it spreads and why it affects some people more than others. There's also something we have published on called cognitive reserve. And that's the idea that's well known in Alzheimer's disease, that basically the smarter someone is and the higher functioning their brain is, the better they can perform even with brain disease. And so that's why you see, and like there's, you know, you look up the nun study, this famous study of nuns, they sort of were surprised to find that many of them, you know, seem to have Alzheimer's pathology, you know, in sometimes severe ways, but they weren't diagnosed with Alzheimer's and people said they were functioning fine. And so I think that goes to the individual variation, and that's why it's important that we can't always connect individual pathology to individual symptoms, but there are very large general trends towards you have this much pathology and you're likely to show these types of symptoms. And again, when I mentioned, you know, stage four, when it really has gone everywhere throughout the brain, everybody is affected. There is no resilience to that.
And what I said is accurate about, you know, it's kind of like smoking, where there could be a guy that smokes a pack a day and never has much of a problem with it. And then there could be people that only smoke a couple cigarettes a day and they have lung cancer and die from it. Is there some similar correlation to?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. That's exactly where the data is trending. And that's how we have to understand this. We should never expect 100% of people to get this in any population. But, you know, the reality is, you know, only about I think it's less than 1/5 of people who smoke, you know, significantly and end up with lung cancer. And yet we still think that's so horrible that we, you know, made it illegal for children and, you know, tax the heck out of it and have ads every day saying don't smoke. So we, you know, but all the data we have says it's not the concussions. We aren't seeing a good correlation with number of diagnosed concussions or how severe they were and whether or not you have the disease or how severe it is. But we are starting to see general trends of the more hits you took based on, you know, our estimates of sports and histories. We have a publication, it came out with something called the Cumulative Head Impact Index. The higher your score on that, the more likely you are to have symptoms, the more likely you are to have changes in your brain. And then, you know, and that sort of makes sense because you think about smoking and lung cancer, you sort of look back at someone's risk throughout their life and they had a, you know, 80% risk of not having it, but then they do. Well, which cigarette was the one that put them over the top? Like, you can never go find that. I think we'll find the same way with these hits. We're never going to be able to tell which hit started it or if multiple hits started it multiple times. So that's why we have to do more work.
Is there a sweet spot that you've seen so far, Chris, that where if a person plays less than 5 years, they're generally okay, or less than 7 or something like that?
No, I don't think we have the data to say that. I think we can say that less is more, but I think we can also say that we have had cases that have played fewer than 5 years of football and have had CTE. So there's probably no protective amount. In theory, there's no reason why you couldn't get it after one season, although it's probably extraordinarily unlikely.
Last question, Chris. What do you think about, like, going back to leather helmets or, like, Olympic boxing headgear or something like that that would, I believe, and I'm not suggesting they should do this, but I have thought about it, as a way to cut way, way down on the repetitive hits to the head?
No, it's a fun thought experiment. How do you change the game? And we try to keep the conversation focused on, you know, we think the best solutions for everybody in football is to, you know, shorten the number of years you play. Don't play as a child when your brain's more vulnerable. Then play tackle, you know, go ahead and play tackle in high school if you want to. And then let's work within the system to make the game safer. You know, I think, you know, minimizing hitting in practice is still the number one solution within football to lower risk. And then, yeah, you can start having fun with the face masks and the helmets. I mean, the problem with leather helmets is, you know, to unteach football players to play the way they've been playing is really, really hard. And so you're going to end up, if you just took a high school team and said next year you're playing with other helmets, you'd have a ton of skull fractures and kids would die. So you can't make that change. And with face masks, the same thing would happen, that maybe eventually over time they could adapt, but immediately asking them to adapt is insane. And if you had no face mask, you'd end up with people losing eyes and losing their vision, and people would, you know, that would not be acceptable. So, you know, we're sort of burying the problem inside the brain by adding all this armor, where they can walk away. They're burying, you know, they're not bleeding, they're not complaining, but they might be, you know, starting a fire inside their brain that would go the rest of their lives.
Chris, really appreciate the time, always. And like I always say, thank you so much personally from me and my family for the work that you guys are doing. It's very, very important. That very likely will impact me at some point in my life. So I'm glad we have you on the case.
Let's hope not, buddy. But we're out here fighting the battle for you and your family, and I appreciate you committing both your brain and your time to this cause. You're a good man.
So important, the work that Chris and his group is doing, are doing. I am so thankful for people like that, that at least we have more knowledge than we had before, and hopefully they'll continue to make progress over the next few years, 5, 10, 15, 20. I think everybody wants more progress in that area for us to be able to answer more of those questions. There is one question that doesn't need to be answered, however, and that is, what's the best hummus on the planet? Because it's been answered by my dudes and, frankly, my dudettes over at Lantana Hummus. Absolutely delicious. I had like 8 of these different canisters of them, containers. I only have 2 left. I think I got like sriracha carrot. I got to look. Oh, and the white bean, which I already had one of the white beans. Spicy. So freaking good, dude. So good. Brian, I'm kind of a hummus freak and cannot believe I just found out about Lantana. It's legitimately awesome. Available at over 400 grocery retailers nationwide. Just look for the hummus with the striped lids in the deli. So here's all you need to think about. Striped lids in the deli, or look for Lantana. Just remember, Ross, Lantana, Lantana, Ross. Go to LantanaFoods.com so you can find what grocery store near you has Lantana hummus. If you like hummus even a little bit, I guarantee it's the best tasting you've ever had. Money back guarantee. No, not money back guarantee, but I guarantee it. Money back on the podcast, on what you paid for the podcast to listen to it today. Guarantee. Boom.
Tuck's Takes.
Hey, Ross, lots to get to today. It's a Monday, it's August, which means there's a lot of NFL news. Let's start with Anquan Boldin. He leaves camp and retires from the Bills yesterday.
Yeah, it came down late last night, Bri, and I actually just spoke to Anquan, you know, 15 minutes ago. Not even. I just finished up the radio show, and now we're recording the podcast. Because I think a lot of people probably had the same reaction to the news. No matter what statement he put out there, I think a lot of people probably felt like, you know, the Bills' trades of Sammy Watkins and Ronald Darby were a major contributing factor to him deciding to retire. And while I would tell you, I don't know how that those things could help. You know, I don't know how that could help. He was very clear. It's funny because I asked him why now, and he said, seeing things transpire over the last week or so. And the way he said that, I thought, oh, man. You know, he's talking about the moves the Bills made, the trades. But then he said there are things bigger than football. And I asked him to clarify, and he said he was talking about Charlottesville and some of the other protests and demonstrations. He went on to say, and I put all this on Twitter, by the way, if you want to check it out, at Ross Tucker NFL, Bri is at RTF Podcast. He went on to say, I'm uncomfortable with how divided we are as a country. This is not a fly-by-night decision. It's something I want to dedicate my life to. And perhaps most importantly for fantasy purposes and for folks that were skeptical of his motivation for retiring, I asked him if there's any chance he'd sign late in the season for a contender. He said, no, I'm done with the sport of football. My passion is elsewhere. And that guy is one of the receivers I respect the most in my time in the NFL. You know, when you earn the other player's respect, there's nothing quite like it. And he's a top five receiver. I don't mean necessarily talent or whatever, although I'm sure that could be argued. But in terms of the respect I have for him, and top 20 player overall, he's probably a top two or three receiver, really. Just in terms of the way he went about his business. Unbelievable mental toughness and physical toughness. And just remember this. When you get to the combine next February and we're talking about it, dude ran a 4.71 40 at the combine. 4.71. Ninth most catches in NFL history. Obviously, for the Bills, it's not good. And, you know, they've got to be up there with the Baltimore's, San Diego, Chargers, LA Chargers, and the Dolphins in terms of teams whose prospects for this season have changed the most during camp.
Tux Takes.
Speaking of retirement, former Raven linebacker Zachary Orr officially retired again, this time after no teams would clear him to play given his neck condition.
Right. I guess, you know, he had met with a couple of doctors. They said you can't play. Then he found one that said he talked with somebody, a kid from Baylor, a quarterback that used to play at Baylor, Seth Russell, I think, who told him you should go see my doctor. And that doctor cleared him. But then he was not able to get any other team doctors to actually clear him. It sounded like he wanted to play, but no team would pass him and give him clearance to play. So, you know, the Zach Orr situation is like a lot of things in life. He's coming off a Pro Bowl year, and you can choose to look at it two ways. One way would be, what an absolute shame that he can't continue his career. The other way would be, what a blessing that he never did get paralyzed or lose his life playing linebacker in the NFL with that neck condition that they didn't know about till now. So I'm a glass half full guy, so I'm glad that he got to play for 3 years. He's healthy. He's out of it. And the Ravens reportedly would hire him for coaching or scouting. That's great. Good for him.
Tux Takes.
Well, more Ravens news. The team agreed to terms with lineman Jeremy Zuta on a deal to bring him back.
Yeah, I mean, he just played for them the last few years. Then they trade him to San Francisco for not much, frankly, just to move up in the sixth round a little bit. But they were ready to move on from Jeremy. But things change in the NFL. Things change quickly. Zuta got cut by the Niners, who wanted to go with Kilgore and Tim Barnes at the center position. They didn't want to pay Zuta what he was due. And the Ravens had a bunch of injuries. You know, you look at Siragusa got hurt, the fourth round pick. Urschel retires. Then you got Alex Lewis getting hurt. And that was already a concern, a position of concern, the O-line. So now I think they'll be able to put Zuta at center, put Jensen at left guard, maybe have him compete with Hurst at left guard. They can bump out Yanda and Hurst to the tackles if they have to. So now they're actually getting at least serviceable depth, you know, at least having a sixth guy that they could feel comfortable putting on the field. So I like that signing by the Ravens.
Tux Takes.
All right, and some other news. Le'Veon Bell reportedly nixing a deal that his agent had already agreed to with the Steelers. Dolphins signed Ray Maluga. And the Seahawks having the worst injury of the weekend with starting left tackle George Fant going down. He tore his ACL.
Right. And I guess he had progressed a lot from last year, and they were feeling good about him. They were feeling really good about George Fant. Now they're going to have to either put Reese Odhiambo or Luke Jokel in. Not good, man. I mean, not good that they finally felt like the left side was settled, and now it's jumbled again. Ray Maluga, it sounds to me like the Dolphins want a hammerhead middle backer for obvious rundown. That's why they drafted McMillan. And I don't think that they think Mike Hall, even though I think Mike will play well, you know, he's a little undersized. I don't think that they think he fits that role. And as for Le'Veon Bell and his agent, I mean, number one, what's his agent going to say? His agent can't let that story be out there. Otherwise, it makes him look bad as an agent. And by the way, the story makes Le'Veon look bad for nixing the deal. So the agent wants to get his 3% of Le'Veon's money. So he doesn't want that out there. So the agent did the only thing he had to do. I don't think that the Steelers would lie, though. I think that they probably were led to believe that he had agreed to the deal, and then Le'Veon turned it down. In terms of the games, Bri, and what I got to watch, I'll just give you my quick stock up, stock down, like I like to do. Stock up Dalvin Cook in Minnesota again. How about Kaysen Williams and Chris Carson in Seattle? I swear the Seahawks find these guys out of nowhere. Kaysen Williams and Chris Carson? Stock up McCaffrey again for the Panthers. Bruce Ellington in Houston making plays. How about for the Rams? Jared Goff and Marlon Mack. I'm sorry, Jared Goff and Cooper Kupp looked really good for the Rams. For the Cowboys-Colts game, Marlon Mack is the truth for the Colts at running back. Too bad not a lot of other players on the team are. And Jalen Smith, stock up for him just to be playing out there. Tariq Cohen, the young running back at North Carolina A&T for the Bears. Stock up for Tom Savage, much better than his first week. And Alvin Kamara from the Saints, another rookie runner, looking pretty darn good. Stock down, Eddie Lacy. I mean, he's like third running back for the Seahawks right now. Paxton Lynch, that'll be a done deal that they named Trevor Siemian the starter sooner rather than later in Denver. Paxton Lynch not able to take the bull by the horns there. Hackenberg, boy, he did a lot of positive things last week. Not so much this week. And I would just say in general, we mentioned it with Anquan Boldin, but stock down Bills, stock down Chargers. I mean, they're just getting destroyed in the preseason. I think they'll be good. I think they'll be better than that, but a lot of people have them win the division. I don't know. And stock down Colts. They have been awful, awful so far, and it feels like Chuck Pagano knows it. It also feels like wearing underwear that isn't Saks underwear is terrible. Don't do it. Wear Saks underwear. I'm wearing it right now. It's a game changer. I adore the ballpark pouch. It's perfect. It gently cups your you-know-what, keeping them where they should be, right? Here's how I would describe it, dudes. If you've never tried it, you don't know there's a difference. That's the only way I can describe it to you. If you've never tried underwear with a ballpark pouch like Saks, you literally don't know what you're missing, because I wouldn't have known what I was missing until I tried it. And now I've gone out. How many times, Bri, have you gone and bought more Saks?
Just placed my third order. Just got it in last week, actually.
I have done the same. I've made three orders, because it's to the point where it's legitimate disappointment when I go and I don't have Saks to put on that day. So what are you waiting for? Order a few pairs today just so you know what Bri and I are talking about. Go to saxxunderwear.com/Tucker. That's S-A-X-X, Saks with two X's, and you get 20% off your first purchase. Again, saxxunderwear.com/Tucker. You get 20% off your first purchase.
Ever wanted to ask an NFL player a question? Well, here's your chance. It's time to ask Ross.
Email address, ross@rostucker.com. Love your emails because, frankly, you're more imaginative, creative than we are. And as such, we love to get your questions. So here's what you do. You take advantage of any of our sponsors, Saks, Lantana, DraftKings, SeatGeek, whoever, and go to our website or just use the code. They'll send you some email. That's the way the world works now. Forward it to me, ross@rostucker.com, with whatever question you got. I guarantee I'll answer it on the show. And I also enter you to win something from me each and every week. So what do you got, Bri?
All right. Hey, Ross, I'm a 19-year-old college student from Redmond, Washington, which is right outside of Seattle. My dad's from Sacramento. He and I are lifelong Raider fans, with the rest of my friends and family root for the Seahawks. Now, knowing only disappointment and frustration with the Raiders for the past 15 years, coupled with the recent success of the Seahawks, nothing would give me more satisfaction than to see the silver and black plow the Hawks in Super Bowl 52. So I got two questions here. Number one, would you agree that this is the most compelling Super Bowl matchup the league has to offer next year? Beast mode back in Oakland against his old team? Then question number two, would you not rather have Carr over Wilson as your quarterback for the future? Russ has a ring, but aside from 2017, to me, he has never asked to do much more than protect the ball, scramble, and avoid pressure until he could throw a bomb to a wide-open receiver. Meanwhile, Carr is on the verge of being an elite pocket passer, and aside from Rodgers and Brady, probably the most clutch player in the game. Thanks, Ross, for the awesome content. Go Huskies. That's from Leo Miller.
Good questions, Leo. I don't think that Seahawks against Raiders is the most compelling Super Bowl matchup. I mean, that would be interesting, but frankly, I think it's got to be the Patriots in the Super Bowl for it to be compelling at this point. I just think people are really curious to see what Brady and Belichick can keep doing. So I think like maybe Packers-Patriots, but I certainly see where you're coming from. I think Seahawks-Raiders would be pretty darn entertaining as well. As for Carr over Wilson, no, I would not, Leo. I think you make a good point about Carr being clutch and an elite pocket passer. But what I would tell you is, number one, you know, he's the guy that broke his leg last year. And, you know, Russell Wilson's never missed a game. So in terms of, you know, injury, not longevity, Russell Wilson's never missed a game in 4 years. Was it 4 or 5 years at this point? Meanwhile, you know, Derek Carr just broke a leg and missed a couple games in the playoffs. Plus, I am conservative by nature. And I've seen Russell Wilson do it. I've seen him win a bunch of games in the playoffs. I've seen him be clutch. I've seen him make smart decisions. I have not seen Derek Carr do that yet in the playoffs. So I'd rather go with the known commodity of Russell Wilson than the unknown with, you know, Derek Carr, if I'm picking somebody for the next 10 years. But good question. Really good question. They'll do it. For a Monster Monday edition of the Ross Tucker Football Podcast, always appreciate getting that insight from Chris Nowinski of the Concussion Legacy Foundation. I always appreciate those emails. Hopefully you guys can send some more. Also, I didn't mention this earlier, but the Spread the Word contest via social media is ongoing always. All those retweets and likes really do help us. People see them, so we appreciate it. He's at RTF Podcast. I'm at Ross Tucker NFL everywhere now. Twitter. I am on Instagram now if you want to get that. For those of you that are on Instagram, I'm there. And Facebook as well. Facebook.com/RossTuckerNFL. Other than that, I think we're done here.
Thanks for listening to the Ross Tucker Football Podcast. Make sure to also subscribe to the Fantasy Feast, Even Money, and the College Draft Podcasts. All available on iTunes at RossTucker.com or wherever podcasts can be found.
So I've been telling you guys about TrueCar for a while now. And what's amazing about it is as soon as my wife said, honey, I need to get a new car, I said TrueCar. Because they have the information on anything that's been sold in your area. Think about it. 3 million cars sold, over 13,000 dealers, over 700,000 pre-owned vehicles available, average savings of over $3,000 off MSRP. Using TrueCar, you can easily find the car you want. And here's the key. TrueCar will show you what other people in your area paid for the car you want. Now you know what a fair price is, so you can feel confident. Before we even started looking, she was looking at Explorers, Tahoes. I said, hey, look at TrueCar, and you can find out exactly what other people have paid in the area. It is awesome. True Car customers are more likely to enjoy a faster buying process when they connect with True Car certified dealers. Plus, True Car users save an average of over $3,000 off MSRP. When you're ready to buy, visit True Car to enjoy a more confident car buying experience. Some features not available in all states.